Hello and welcome aboard this podcast of RTÉ Radio 1's maritime programme Seascapes, which is presented and produced by Marcus Connaughton. You can email the programme seascapes@rte.ie. Hello and welcome aboard this week's edition of your maritime programme Seascapes. This week we hear from Padraic Fogarty of the Irish Wildlife Trust and how Irish oysters are under threat from an invasive Pacific species. Clifton-based archaeologist Michael Gibbons talks to Seascapes about the recent treasures uncovered by the storms off the west coast of Ireland. The Round Ireland Yacht Race is now in its 34th year and is Ireland's premier offshore sailing race, attracting entrants from across Europe and as far afield as Russia, the USA and New Zealand. It will depart Wicklow on Sunday the 28th of June at 1400 hours. There are no changes to the race itself other than increasing the maximum number of entries from 75 to 100 yachts. Wicklow Sailing Club continue to run the race under the auspices of the Royal Ocean Racing Club, and the race will start and finish in Wicklow. Last night at the Royal Irish Yacht Club, Wicklow Sailing Club announced details of the Round Ireland Yacht Race. This year's event has some new features, as we hear from race organiser Theo Phelan.
Well, the primary change is that Wicklow have decided to expand the race. And the only way we could do that was to become involved with a base in Dublin. We've ended up going into an association with the Royal Irish Yacht Club in order to establish a base for all pre-race activities, which in turn will now permit us to invite far bigger boats into our race than we could heretofore do so. The tides that you're going to encounter in the Round Ireland race are unique to our country and our island. We have the Atlantic Ocean on one side, you have the Donegal Bay, which is wild, and you have the Irish Sea, which is quite calm, and effectively there's only 56 miles between Dublin and Holyhead. Once we have expanded the race into Dublin, where we have a marina, we now have greater freedom to expand the race to cater for the larger yachts and also to invite bigger boats, which heretofore we were not able to do. It's virtually unlimited. It's whatever the size that can fit into Dublin Bay and into the marina. I suspect that you'd probably be talking about something in the order of about 100 foot being the largest that would be likely to enter it. Most of the boats at the present moment would be working on a 12-month, if not a 24-month programme, the bigger boats in particular. We would hope that eventually it would come to the point that the name Round Ireland would become as synonymous in the yacht racing world as that of the Fastnet. It's a big challenge, but we believe that it's possible. The Fastnet is run every 2 years. That leaves a blank year for somebody to fill. We feel we have the race, and we now feel we have the facilities to fill that space.
The race has been going since 1980. The ISA has been involved since then in terms of helping with the race management, and this year particularly we're keen to try and help raise the profile of the race and attract the really big international boats coming in and to increase the numbers. The Royal Ocean Racing Club of Rourke, who have graded this event as one of the top four races globally in their calendar, it really will help attract the big boys coming in this year. Royal Ocean Racing Club have increased the points that they give for this race. That will attract a major audience. So it's on cue with the Sydney Hobart race or the Fastnet race. Traditionally, this event has attracted maybe between 40 and 50 boats, and if we get 50 plus boats this year, we'd be really, really pleased, and certainly building on in 2016 once the word has got out. Globally, we are, in fact, certainly per capita, we are one of the biggest sailing nations in the world. We're the, in terms of our handicapping, which is the system that the cruisers use in order to race and handicap themselves, we're the Royal Ocean Racing Club's biggest customer for our handicaps. They would see our system running in parallel with the Echo handicap system, which is a local handicapping system, as an example that they're now trying to promote worldwide. and we have the UK now who have just come on board with their version of ECHO. Australia are looking at it, and Canada are looking at it as well. So in terms of our presence internationally, we're a very big nation. In terms of our ability to host events, we prove time and time again that our race management, our organisation, our hospitality, everything that goes on the water is absolutely world class.
The voice there of Harry Herman, CEO of the Irish Sailing Association. And before that, we heard from Theo Phelan, race organiser at the launch last night in the Royal Irish Yacht Club. Next, to the Commodore of Wicklow Sailing Club, Peter Shearer.
Well, this is a great step forward for the organisation of the Round Ireland, because it means that the larger yachts will now have a dedicated base in Dunleary. With the assistance of the Royal Irish, and we're delighted to be working with them on this, the larger yachts will have a dedicated race office up here so that they can get the full pre-race inspection by the Rourke inspectors. They will also have the facilities of the marina. They will be able to use the facilities in the Royal Irish and, of course, the Chandlers up the street as well, and so on. But essentially, it's a big move forward for those bigger yachts who need that sort of extra depth and so on to be able to take advantage of, and we're delighted with this progress. The race will still always start and finish in Wicklow. We've set the race start for a falling tide from Wicklow, which means that the tide will be rising that morning, and that may present somewhat of a challenge for some of the boats coming down from Dunleary. So some may choose to come down on the Friday to catch the falling tide on the Friday, and perhaps some of the bigger boats wouldn't be so bothered by the tide. They might come down against the tide on Saturday morning. And it's really only in response to a demand for the bigger, more professional boats to provide a dedicated base in Dunleary that we're moving in this direction.
I'm Ronald Koelink from the Netherlands, a sailing photographer. Happy to attend the launch of the Irish Yacht Race. Because we can't sail around the Netherlands. This race is for the yachts in the Netherlands. The race yachts and the bigger yachts is a good race, a convenient distance, and you can sail with your crew in a few days. We don't have those events in the Netherlands. I'll do my best to encourage other teams to come to Ireland.
Satanta Colum Ballasty. I'm 10 years of age. I'm one of the youngest members of Wicklow Sailing Club. Well, I've done the Carnamara course, which was done by the ISA. I did that last summer. This year, I'm doing my level one, or the orcas. The kind of training we did was, on some days we would go out, we would sail for some of the day. Other days we'd come in, we'd be inside if it was really, really wet. It starts in Wicklow. Last year I know there was a boat from Wicklow called Pride of Wicklow. Probably come in the top five, but, you know, probably not the top two.
The Round Ireland Yacht Race takes place in June, and you can find more detail on the ISA website and the Wicklow Sailing Club dedicated website, www.roundirelandyachtrace.ie. Next, here on Seascapes, we hear how Irish oysters are under threat from an invasive species, the Pacific oyster. In our studios in Donnybrook is Padraig Fogarty of the Irish Wildlife Trust. Padraig, tell us more about this problem and the organisation called Invasive Species Ireland.
Invasive Species Ireland was set up a good few years ago, and at the time it was quite ahead of the game in European context for identifying invasive species, more or less trying to get ahead of them and alerting the relevant authorities when a species had come into the country. Unfortunately, the government has cut the funding to Invasive Species Ireland in the last year, and as I understand it at the moment, it's in a certain hiatus at the moment, which is a terrible shame, because invasive species are one of the biggest threats to our biodiversity and have huge economic consequences as well.
Now, these specific oysters, as you say, have been grown in terms of sort of aquaculture. One wouldn't expect them to thrive in these waters, because they really depend on warm water, don't they?
From what I believe, they're favoured by the growers because they grow quicker than the native oyster. So you can get a turnaround on your crop as such in a shorter space of time. They were brought in, I think, in France originally, perhaps in the 1970s. Unfortunately, when they were brought in, they brought in a number of other things with them, various parasites and diseases that went unnoticed. But unfortunately, they're making their presence felt now as well. We're quite confused and concerned really as to why Invasive Species Ireland have not identified the Pacific oyster as invasive. They have established themselves particularly along the coast of Holland, where they're completely outcompeting the native oysters and the native biodiversity. And so we would like to see action being taken. There was research carried out in UCD that was published last year that showed that the Pacific oyster is now breeding independently in a number of locations, up in Lough Swilly, for instance.
Now, this all came to light as a result of a survey that was undertaken by the Environmental Protection Agency, and they found evidence that these oysters are in quite a number of locations around the country. They're certainly concentrated in Lough Foyle, by all accounts, and also, horrifyingly enough, in somewhere like Galway Bay. And I mean, the amount of money that oysters generate would be in, what, about 34, 35 million a year?
I mean, ideally, what we'd like to see is more economic activity being directed towards the native oyster. The native oyster is more suited to our climate, it's more suited to our sea marine conditions, and it's also associated with a huge level of other biodiversity that once thrived on the native oyster bed. So the growth of Pacific oysters in these areas is a worry, and it's bad news for aquaculture people as well. The beds of Pacific oysters and native oysters were wiped out in Carlingford only last summer. So when diseases come in to invasive species as well, it can be devastating for the people concerned. The Pacific oyster obviously was brought in. It wouldn't have arrived on its own without a human intervention. One of the diseases, the particular virus that caused the collapse of the oysters in Carlingford Lough last summer, was directly related to rising sea temperatures. The water temperature went above 16 degrees, and it's understood that this virus, which was there all along, was suddenly activated by the high water temperatures and caused this devastation. Most animals will be able to go to deeper waters where the waves are, the effects of the waves are much, much less. Waves increase in height as they get closer to the shore, so it's really only the shallow waters that are affected by the wave action. It does affect animals like seals, particularly young seals that may not have had an opportunity to haul out of the land. They have to haul out and rest every now and again, so they can die of exhaustion. And I came across a dead seal myself in Wexford during the week that probably succumbed to the winter storms. And also for birds as well, you would expect a number of birds not to be able to survive the continued storms. It's a reminder that our coast is constantly being formed and reformed, and it's very, very dynamic. Unfortunately, human development has encroached on a lot of these areas, so they don't have. If you take sand dunes, for example, sand dunes are constantly being eroded and reforming, but things like piers and towns and roads kind of prevent that natural process from taking place. So you can find the natural habitats get squeezed, but you can also then find that the erosive forces are concentrated then in other areas that may not have been expected.
The Irish Wildlife Trust obviously keeping an eye on right around our coastline on a constant basis. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, that's right. We have quite an active campaign that we call our Sustainable Seas. We try to promote a more sustainable use of our seas and promote protection of the wildlife that's in the marine area. We're at www.iwt.ie, and we have lots of branches all over the country, a lot of them in coastal areas, Waterford, Galway, Mayo, for instance. And we have lots of local events for people, which are normally free. So we'd encourage people to get involved.
Padraig Fogarty of the Irish Wildlife Trust. You can read more about this topic on the Trust's website, www.iwt.ie, or on the Seascapes webpage, which as usual is www.rte.ie/radio1/seascapes. Much devastation was caused recently to our remarkable coastline. We hear now how the storms uncovered medieval burial sites, sunken dwellings, and parts of a Neolithic bog. We head to our Galway studios, where we can hear from archaeologist Michael Gibbons.
It's like peeling back a page of history. We're losing some bit of the pages of the book, but there's other pages that we haven't seen before are coming to life. Yes, there's been settlements discovered there now on the surgeon sea has torn back to the sand and has turned over at the very base an intertidal peat. And this is showing evidence of a former landscape that's now drowned under the water. And you've got the timbers visible on the land and sea edge. So you get just glimpses of a large landscape. It's actually the new frontier in Irish archaeology. The world in the shallow seas off the Irish coast. So lots of material coming out of that.
It's a remarkable thing when something like this happens, but also it gives us a sense of our ancestors and what went on from the point of view of dwellings, of burial sites, and of course bogs that existed.
Yeah, well, what the surgeons are going is you're getting a little keyhole into a whole series of events stretching over the last 7,000 years. One of the sites, for example, impacted are there's a series of children's burial grounds right on the shore. Now, they were built there because they're on the liminal zone between this world and the next. Now, several of those have been destroyed and are badly damaged. And they're one of the least studied sites on the Irish landscape and least known, sort of secretive places. But one of them on the coast of Inverurie, a beautiful 19th century slab turned up, and it showed that graveyard not just was as a children's graveyard, but some adults were buried there as well. And the adults were strangers, of course, from the area. And there were often people who were buried there are people who were drowned, washed up ashore, suicide victims, or children who died without baptism, or people strange from the locality. And at this particular spot, there was an evangelical mission settlement right next to it at Cashel. So they're probably buried there because they're associated with that community of converted families. So fascinating glimpse into the 19th century. On in Ishboffin, a bar-kicking pan was very badly damaged. It was the best preserved one in the whole country. That's where the sails were barked, boiled in a pot to waterproof the sails. And you had an apron and a whole structure there. Now, that's been under my mind. Now, it's a key part of Irish 19th century maritime history. And so we hope we get some funds from the council to do some more work on that. And on the opposite side, on Inishark Harbour, you have St. Leo's Holy Island of Shark. The graveyard there, right above the pier, that was completely gutted by the storm. And early Christian crosses, 19th century burials and modern burials just scattered. So that was a very severe loss to the descendants of those islanders. The dune systems are the most fragile systems we have. But ironically, they're also the richest archaeological landscapes we have along the coast. And literally kilometres of those have been torn off. And in the tearing, of course, a series of sunken houses have turned up at Port na Fadhlago near Rowanstone, at two sections at Omi Island. And this is where people who lived on the shore but dug their house into the sand. And so you have a lovely cross-section of these buildings now, as they were, and they will crumble into the sea now. So we have a little window to map them, record them and study them. And so there's Bronze Age sites elsewhere being damaged. So a whole range of sites.
I suppose one of the remarkable things, Michael, is the fact that the sea comes in, it uncovers this, and then within a matter of a short space of time, it then seals it all up again.
Yeah, well, that's the big thing. There's a dynamic process underway. It's been underway for a millennium, and we have a little window to get at it. Finnish Island now off the South Connemara coast, it's been gutted by the storm. And Michael Moylan, a local field archaeologist there, has found a series of dog whelk middens there, which are fascinating in their own way. And just opposite there now, two stone accesses have turned up, which are from the end of the hunter-gatherer age, the beginnings of the first farmers in the West. And so you've got some remarkable society. But this has been going on for millennia. One of the areas where we're exposed is a place called just east of the village of Cleggan. You have a lovely little harbour, Bundowlish. It's a shingle beach. The sea has been pushed back. Now it's demolished walls and all along the farms there. But it has revealed the ancient forest there, metres so high, a whole line of them right along the edge of the tide. And they date back about 3000 BC. Elsewhere on the Rhineval coast, a similar forest is visible. But you also have them on the Clare coast down there, Carrigargo Holt, in that area. So there's a bit cleaning out these ancient landscapes, visible for a while, and nature will cover them back in again. Our house overlooks the sea. And these were wild, stormy conditions. No boats would have survived them. And of course, up till the lighthouse of service was established, winter storms carried off hundreds of ships every winter and autumn in these masses of storms. And of course, these ships now, some of them are being uncovered also in under the sands. The wonderful one at Lembe, but also others along the coast.
We were decrying the fact on Seascapes last Friday night, the fact that people would dare to interfere with something like the Sunbeam on Rathbay Strand, and the fact that now the council down there are going to have to rebury the vessel.
Yeah, it's extraordinary. But some people do it out of ignorance. I don't think they're going down maliciously. But you know, these are structures, they're historic features. You can photograph them. There's some wonderful photographs done by the South Kerry Photographic Club. So don't touch these. Photograph them, pass them on. Because this is valuable archival material. It'll provide insights to our history, our maritime history, for the years ahead. We have loads of very... Docky Island, for example, now just off Dublin, has side Mesolithic middens there going back about 8,000 years. And these were your burnt stone, shell, so they're the refuse of seasonal settlers living on the coast. And over time, a mound of refuse builds up around the settlement. So they're the most obvious sites you'll see. You'll see the shell, the bone, and typically the burnt stone, fire crack stone in them. And some of them are very ancient. At Cullinamore now on Sligo, underneath Knocknarea, I worked as a student there, and the middens there are metres deep. Also, Inner Galway Bay, last year we did a survey, and we found that the biggest group of middens in the country are Kilcoggan, Kinvara Bay, Achanish Island, all along on that coast. Now, they've been trashed, a lot of those middens. And these are oyster middens. Elsewhere, they're dog whelk. Elsewhere, they're barnyards. So there's a whole variety of them. But they're fascinating sites.
Archaeologist Michael Gibbons, Next week on Seascapes, we'll be talking to Brendan Murray of Belmullet Arts Centre about an ITP 47 buoy which travelled from the Arctic to Belmullet on the west coast. Last week we heard the story of the Summit Canal from Hugh Oram on the Newry to Lough Neagh system. Well, we had an email from a great friend of the programme, Geraldine Foley, reminding us that she's a member of the Inland Waterways Association of Ireland in Newry and Portadown branch. We are a volunteer group doing restoration work on the Newry Canal. You can read more about the country's oldest canal at www.facebook.com/Newry Portadown Canal. The Clipper Round the World Yacht Race fleet are passing the outer islands of Papua New Guinea, headed for Singapore in what can only be described as light airs at the mercy of ocean currents. The overall current race leader is 1DLL, followed by Switzerland and Henri Lloyd. More detail and images on www.clipperroundtheworld.com. Next week here on Seascapes, we hear about the remarkable journey of an Arctic buoy, ITP 47, which washed up on the Mullet Peninsula and was discovered by Fergus Sweeney. Brendan Murray, Artistic Director of Belmullet Arts Centre, will explain the background and an exhibition in Áras Inishtluaire. We'll hear more about the safety code of practice for small fishing vessels. Colin Becker of Inland Waterways Association of Ireland on the proposed bylaw amendments by Waterways Ireland and a fast approaching deadline. Inhabiting the Shannon Estuary, a photographic exhibition opens in the Glucksman Library in Limerick. All that and much more. Until next Friday night, tight lines and fair sailing.